And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, today is August the 4th, 216th day of the year. 149 days remain till this year's over with. Y'all have asked for holidays and observances. So we got, International Beer Day. National Chocolate Chip Cookie Day. Assistance Dog Day. Brahmin Pie Day. Cook Islands Constitution Day. Founders Day. That's how Ghana gained its independence. Hooray for Kids Day. International Clouded Leopard Day. Mary Prince Day. Matisse Slavinska Day. National Water Balloon Day. National White Wine Day. Single Working Women's Day. And U.S. Coast Guard's birthday was today. Umaganura Day. This is a day not to forget. Talking about things not to forget. As of yesterday, our former president's been had 78 charges in one form or another, state and federal, filed against him, which, from my view, is all done just simply to keep him from running for president in 2024. You know, keep in mind that one of the games the feds like to play is they'll bring 100 charges against you. And if you plead guilty to the one they want, they'll drop all the rest. It's a waste of money. It destroys people's lives. But as long as the federal attorney wins, he doesn't care. I've had federal attorneys tell me they didn't care what the law was. It was going to be what they wanted. They have a feeling of being a god when they become a U.S. attorney. And something in the law called res judicata and collateral estoppel means once decided, always decided. And when something's decided by a court, that can be brought up if you're charged again. Now, there's certain requirements, of course, but when you're charged again, if anything was decided in the first trial, the first decision stands. Unless it was appealed. And then, so far, there haven't been any appeals by anybody in this case. It's just been abuse of the legal system to keep the man from running for office. Well, in 598 A.D., Goguryeo-Suiwar War. In response to a Korean incursion into Liaoxi, Emperor Wendi of Sui orders his youngest son, Yang Yang, assisted by the co-prime minister, Gao Jiang, to conquer Goguryeo during the Manchurian rainy season with the Chinese Army and Navy. 1265, the Second Barons' War, Battle of Evesham, army of Prince Edward, future King Edward I of England. Defeats the forces of rebellious barons led by Sama de Montfort, 6th Earl of Leicester, killing de Montfort and many of his allies. 1327, First War of Scottish Independence, James Douglas leads a raid into Weardale and almost kills Edward III of England. 1578, the Battle of Alcácer, Al-Kabir, the Moroccans defeat the Portuguese. King Sebastian of Portugal is killed in the battle, leaving his elderly uncle, Cardinal Henry's, is there. Of course, that results in a succession crisis in Portugal. 1693, the date traditionally ascribed to Dom Perignon's invention of champagne. It's not clear whether he actually invented champagne, but he's been credited as an innovator who developed the techniques used to perfect the sparkling wine. 1701, the Great Peace of Montreal between New France and the First Nations is signed. 1704, War of the Spanish Succession. Gibraltar is captured by an English and Dutch fleet commanded by Admiral Sir George Rooke and allied with Archduke Charles. 1783, Mount Isama erupts in Japan, killing about 1,400 people. Eruption caused a famine, which resulted in an additional 20,000 deaths. 1789, France, abolition of feudalism by the National Constituent Assembly. 1790, a newly passed Tariff Act creates the Revenue Cutter Service. That was the forerunner of the U.S. Coast Guard. 1791, a Treaty of Sestova signed, ending the Ottoman-Habsburg Wars. 1796, French Revolutionary Wars. Napoleon leads the French Army of Italy to victory in the Battle of Lonnato. 1821, Saturday Evening Post is published for the first time as a weekly newspaper. 1854, Dan Omaru establishes his official flag to be flown from Japanese ships. 1863, Matica Slavinska, Slovakia's public law, culture, and scientific institution focusing on topics around the Slovak nation is established in Martin. 1873, American Indian Wars, by protecting Railroad Survey Party Montana, the 7th Cavalry under Lieutenant Colonel George Custer clashes for the first time with the Cheyenne and the Lakota people near the Tongue River. Only one man on each side is killed in this particular engagement. 1889, the Great Fire of Spokane, Washington destroys 32 blocks of the city, prompting a mass rebuilding project. 1892, the father's stepmother, Lizzie Borden, are found murdered in her Fall River, Massachusetts home. She'd be tried and acquitted for the crimes a year later. They never did determine who actually killed him. 1914, World War I, response to the German invasion of Belgium. Belgium and the British Empire declare war on Germany. The U.S. declares neutrality. 1915, World War I, the German 12th Army occupies Warsaw during the Gorlick-Tarnow Offensive and the Great Retreat of 1915. 1921, Bolshevik-Makhanovist conflict. Mikhail Frunze declares victory over the Makhanovichina. 1924, diplomatic relations between Mexico and the Soviet Union are established. 1936, Prime Minister of Greece, Ioannis Metaxas, suspends Parliament and the Constitution, establishes the 4th of August regime. 1944, the Holocaust, a tip from a Dutch informer leads the Gestapo to a sealed-off area in an Amsterdam warehouse where they find and arrest Jewish diarist Anne Frank, her family, and four others. 1944, under the state of emergency law, the Finnish Parliament elects Marshal C.G.E. Mannerheim as the President of Finland to replace the resigned Risto Raiti. 1946, an earthquake of magnitude 8.0 hits Northern Dominican Republic. 100 are killed, 20,000 are left homeless. 1947, the Supreme Court of Japan is established. 1964 is the Civil Rights Movement. Civil rights workers Michael Schwerner, Andrew Goodman, and James Chaney are found dead in Mississippi after disappearing on June 21st. 1964 also saw the second Gulf of Tonkin incident. U.S. destroyers USS Maddox and USS Turner Joy mistakenly report coming under attack in the Gulf of Tonkin. Mistakenly report, yeah. 1965, the Constitution of the Cook Islands comes into force, giving the Cook Islands self-governing status within New Zealand. 1969, Vietnam War. And the apartment of French intermediary Jean Saint-Tinian, Paris. American Representative Henry Kissinger and North Vietnamese Representative Van Thuy began secret police negotiations. These negotiations eventually fail. 1972, Ugandan President Idi Amin Dada announces Uganda is no longer responsible for the care of British subjects of Asian origin. That begins the expulsion of Ugandan Asians. 1974, a bomb explodes in the Italicus Express train in San Bernadette, Val di Sambro, Italy, killing 12, wounding 22. 1975, the Japanese Red Army takes more than 50 hostages at the AIA building housing several embassies in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. Hostages included the U.S. consul and the Swedish Charge d'Affaires. The gunmen win the release of five imprisoned comrades and fly with them to Libya. 1977, President Jimmy Peanut Man Carter signs legislation creating the United States Department of Energy. 1983, Jean-Baptiste Ouédraogo President of the military government of Revolt was ousted from power in a coup d'etat led by Captain Thomas Sankara. 1984, the Republic of Volta changes its name to Burkina Faso. 1987, the Federal Communications Commission rescinds the Fairness Doctrine to require radio and TV stations to present controversial issues fairly. And yes, it, which gave rise to such things as CNN. 1995, Operation Storm begins in Croatia. 2006, the massacre is carried out by Sri Lankan government forces, killing 17 employees at a French NGO, Action Against Hunger, known internationally as Action Contre la Faim, or ACF. 2007, NASA's Phoenix spacecraft is launched. 2018, Syrian civil war. Syrian democratic forces expelled the Islamic State of Iraq and Levant from the Iraq-Syria border, concluding the second phase of Deir ez-Zor campaign. 2019, 9 people are killed and 26 injured in a shooting in Dayton, Ohio. That comes only 13 hours after another mass shooting in El Paso, Texas, where 23 people were killed. That happened at Walmart. And in fact, the shooter took our parking space when we left. We had been there. And I seen somebody wandering across the parking lot with ear protectors and carrying a rifle. I would have probably have said something. Nobody else did. And in 2020, Beirut port explosion, at least 220 people were killed and 5,000 are wounded when 2,700 tons of ammonium nitrate explode in Beirut, Lebanon. Of course, it was an accident. Nothing to see here. Move along. The interesting thing. There have been so many violations of the law, and the governmental response has been to do away with cash bail in California and other places, and treat the offender with the greatest of deference, especially if they're undocumented immigrants. They just let in a convicted rapist out of prison because he's an undocumented immigrant. He's not being deported. He's being tapped on the head and told to go sin no more. Please. Okay, we're going to talk a little more about the CIA right after I finish my pontification. It's interesting to note that some of the CIA's greatest successes have been kept quiet. One of these was the exfiltration of U.S. citizens from revolutionary Iran in 1980. It was a wild, stranger than fiction operation, dramatized by the 2012 film Argo, which was directed and produced and starred Ben Affleck. It's based on a former CIA officer by the name of Tony Mendez's book by the same name. And it told the story of what was called the Canadian Caper. It was a joint CIA-Canadian operation to rescue U.S. Diplomats who had managed to avoid capture when allegedly Iranian students seized the U.S. embassy. If they were students, I'm a member of the CIA myself. Now these, as I said, these diplomats had managed to get to the Canadian ambassador's home. So Tony Mendez, they got the hiccups now. And other officers pretended to be a Canadian film crew, scouting locations for a science fiction film. And under this cover story. They infiltrated Iran, contacted the U.S. diplomatic personnel who were hiding at the Canadian ambassador's home. The CIA created fake credentials. So Mendez was able to successfully rescue the six Americans. Now, the mission was classified until 1997. I saw the film. It was very good. Received 7 Academy Award nominations, and they won 3. Best Picture, excuse me, Best Adapted Screenplay, and Best Film Editing. Now, it was said by NPR, he was never liked any success that the CIA's ever had. That the film took so many liberties, it was too good to be true because it isn't. And of course, the movie downplayed Canada's role in the rescue, despite the fact that in 1980, the Canadians took sole credit for the operation in order to avoid worsening U.S.-Iranian relations. And the tension-filled last act, where it seemed as though the Iranians would see through the deception at any moment, was fiction. According to Mendez, the trip to the airport was smooth as silk. But in addition to these departures from fact, the film's notable for having welcomed the input of the CIA's Office of Public Affairs, which, among other things, gives the public a right to gain a better understanding of the CIA's intelligence mission. And that wasn't the first time the CIA assisted with the creation of books and films or TV. In 2012 alone, it helped nearly 24 projects. In fact, the CIA assistance in the entertainment industry dates back to at least the 50s, when it funded an animated adaptation of George Orwell's anti-Soviet novel Animal Farm. But when the CIA's role in Argo became public, a lot of folks questioned whether the agency should be spending money, taxpayer dollars, to be specific, to fund movies and TV shows. The left would much rather have them spent on some of their silly projects. You know, frankly, well, after the treatment I received from the CIA a number of years ago, they're not one of my favorite agencies, but at the same time, they did accomplish a great deal. You know, during his 1976 presidential campaign, Ford's successor, former Georgia Governor Jimmy the Peanut Man Carter promised American people, "I'll never lie to you." And that in and of itself was a lie. And his pledge was a direct response to revelations of the pervasive abuses of government power committed by the Eisenhower and Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, and Ford administrations. And yes, Gerald Ford, who had never met an obstacle he couldn't trip over, lied. He lied on the Warren Commission. He's the one that moved Kennedy wounds to match the final findings of the committee. Now, January 24th, 1978, Carter signed Executive Order 12036. That imposed several restrictions on the intelligence agencies, including banning assassination. And in addition, Carter replaced Director of Central Intelligence Bush with Stansfield Turner. And Turner was going to make the world safe for democracy. Now, he tried to appoint a former Kennedy speechwriter, Ted Sorensen, to the post, but Senate wasn't going to have it. The problem is, the people that get appointed to these positions don't have any experience in the areas in which they're going to be appointed. They get appointed simply because of the political influence they have. I'm dealing with an issue right now in the Department of Veterans Affairs. Between photo opportunities and golf course outings and meetings about Washington, the director of the secretary of the VA didn't have time for disabled veterans, just like our congresswoman here, who has told me very clearly to my face, I don't have time for the problems of veterans. I got to worry about undocumented immigrants. So the people that serve this country are not worth her time. But somebody who breaks the law to come here is front and center as far as she's concerned. I just have an issue with that. You know, while the Carter administration was trying to solve the Iranian hostage crisis, it also undertook an operation in Afghanistan that would have wide-ranging consequences for the U.S. Seeking to inflict a wound on the Soviet Union, similar to the one the U.S. got in Vietnam, which happened because the suits got involved in running the show. In 1979, the U.S., acting through the CIA, supported dissident elements in Afghanistan. Afghanistan had long been known as the graveyard of empires. So they were hoping to provoke the Soviet Union to invading the graveyard of empires to prop up the communist cabal that had seized control of the country's government in 78. By the next year, a bloody civil war had broken out with the beleaguered communist government trying to maintain power against several factions, including Islamist guerrillas, collectively called the Mujahideen. Now that's Arabic for those engaged in jihad, the Islamic struggle for justice, a godly rule, or right conduct, which seems to boil down to whatever the senior cleric says is the word of God, or Allah. Carter administration working under the CIA began providing arms and assistance to the Mujahideen in May of 1979. It was Operation Codename Cyclone. Well, December 24th, 1979, the Carter administration got what he wanted. Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan. Well, though Carter and Reagan agreed on very little, both saw supporting the Mujahideen as being in the U.S.'s best interest. So the Reagan administration expanded American support for the Afghan guerrillas. In fact, in late March of 85, President Reagan signed National Security Decision Directive 166 that defined the two principal elements in our Afghanistan strategy as covert action, support to the Afghan resistance, and diplomatic and political strategy to pressure the Soviet Union to withdraw its forces from Afghanistan and to increase international support for the Afghan resistance forces. Also pledged increased effort to achieve these goals, which led the CIA to give Afghan guerrillas shoulder-fired anti-aircraft missiles known as Stingers. Now, the bad side of this is that these Stingers have been used against friendlies. You give somebody a Stinger, no plane is safe. Well, let's move ahead to the war in Iraq. In fact, I got a call wanting to know if I minded being recalled to train troops to go to Iraq. And I said, oh yeah, recall me. I was going to be promoted one grade, and I'd be either XO or commander of a training battalion. And I knew the officer who called me. And he said, why are you being agreeable? You never agreed to anything that's ever been asked of you in the years I've known you. And I said, well, if I get recalled, you're not getting me out this time. Physical injuries or not. He said, we'll call you back. Never heard from him again. Well, there was another major controversy engulfed the agency. And that was its role in the intelligence that the Bush administration used to convince Congress, the American people, to support a preemptive invasion of Iraq. Now, September 11th was initially the impetus for pointing the finger to Iraq, but it turns out Iraq had nothing to do with the attacks on the World Trade Center. But elements within the Bush administration saw an opportunity to neutralize a long-term thorn in the United States' side. And that was Saddam Hussein. And once it became clear the president was wanting to take military action against Iraq, the CIA's intelligence estimates reflected a desire to provide Bush with the evidence he needed. Proof that Iraq was a threat to the U.S. because the country had an active weapons of mass destruction program. Well, initially, the CIA reporting on the issue was qualified. But as the reports worked their way up the national security hierarchy, many of the qualifiers were removed, making the intelligence look more reliable than it actually was. However, by this time, it was Director of Central Intelligence, Tenet, also played a role, telling President Bush in 2002 it was a slam dunk that Iraq was actively producing and stockpiling weapons of mass destruction. After the invasion, when it became clear Iraq possessed no such weapons, and controversy raged about how the CIA could have been wrong, a senior Bush administration official leaked Tenet's comment to journalist Bob Woodward, who reported it in his 2004 book, Plan of Attack. Now, Tenet reacted by resigning the week after the book came out. And when he wrote his own memoirs, as every senior individual seems to do in Washington, he claimed the comment was taken out of text. Well, while the CIA's role in the global war on terrorism made it a lightning rod for criticism of U.S. policy, it also made the agency a leader in the hunt for Osama bin Laden. But interestingly enough, I know from several FBI agents, had he been arrested, there was not enough solid evidence to even have indicted him. So, the best way to get him was to kill him, and that's what happened. The hunt for bin Laden ended nearly a decade after 9/11 when U.S. Navy SEALs breached bin Laden's compound in Abbottabad, Pakistan. Now, how the CIA found him still is unclear to this day. In one version, intelligence gathered from a detainee in 2002 pointed to the identity of bin Laden's courier, which began a multi-year investigation that led to the terrorist compound in Abbottabad. 2015, investigative journalist Seymour Hersh claimed in the London Review of Books the U.S. had actually been tipped off to bin Laden's location by Pakistan's inter-service intelligence, which had kept the terrorist under house arrest since at least 2006. The inter-service intelligence had hoped that by turning him over to the U.S. authorities, it would ingratiate Pakistan to the Obama administration, which would increase foreign aid. Of course, the entire world tried to ingratiate itself to Obama, to include the mainstream media. He could do no wrong. He still can't. Whatever the truth of these stories, what happened next isn't in dispute. May 2, 2011, 23 members of DEVGRU, which was formerly SEAL Team 6, that had been sheep-dipped. In other words, it had been loaned to the CIA. Breached bin Laden's compound and killed the terrorist. Operation Neptune Spear. Well, it was called that because the SEAL's insignia is a trident, was actually a CIA-led operation. That was carried out in collaboration with the Joint Special Operations Command, or JSOC. After they identified bin Laden's body, or the one we assumed to be bin Laden's body, Americans transferred it to the USS Carl Vinson, and he was buried at sea. Well, Congress passed and President George Bush signed the Intelligence Reform and Terrorism Prevention Act of 2004, which created the cabinet-level position of Director of National Intelligence, CIA, the Director of Central Intelligence reports to this, whoever holds that position. The DNI, as he's called, is the President's primary intelligence advisor, though U.S. policymakers continue to rely on the agency for actionable intelligence and covert operations. Today, the CIA is a far cry from that Ivy League preserve it was reputed to be in the 40s and 50s. It boasts of its commitments to hiring diversity, and as I made comment earlier in the previous show, it's got 15 agency resource groups that are working to elevate people not based on qualifications, but on physical characteristics. The sad thing is, that doesn't give the subordinates a lot of confidence when they know that the man that they have to answer to got his job because of his hair color or the fact that he's transgender or some other issue. Now, a little more than 75 to 80 years after its founding, the CIA has grown into one of the largest and best-known intelligence agencies in the world. Its officers operate around the world on behalf of the agency. And it's moved far beyond its original mandate to centralize intelligence collection and dissemination, blazing new methods of spying on the battlefield and the boardroom and even in cyberspace. Over the almost 80 years of its existence, the CIA has established itself as the nation's preeminent intelligence organization and played a leading role in some of the most important events in U.S. history, such as the fall of the Soviet Union and neutralization of Osama bin Laden. But at the same time, it's had a number of failures and operations that have gone off the rails. Iran, Guatemala, Project MKUltra led to international domestic criticism of the agency and its methods. In truth, the full story of the CIA's work has never been told because of the covert nature of the CIA operations. As a consequence, its failures have tended to receive greater attention than its achievements. And unfortunately, that is how things really are in the real world. You achieve something, well, you're supposed to. You fail, oh, it's shouting from the rooftops. You know, one type of fiction I enjoy reading are spy novels. And quite often, former spies write some of the best. And they mix real-life experiences with fictional details in writing these novels. I know spying and espionage go back millennia. In fact, Sun Tzu's 5th century B.C. Treatise, The Art of War, advises readers on the use of spies, which means it was going on before then. You know, spy fiction is much more recent, emerging in the 19th century and coming to its own as a genre in the 20th. In particular, the Cold War helped spur the growth of American spy fiction, which tends to feature protagonists and sometimes antagonists connected to the CIA, and often written by men and women with real-life spying experience. These novelists mix firsthand details with stock thriller elements, utilizing lies to tell the truth, in the words of one writer. First American spy novel was Adams, published in 1949, written by Paul Leinbarger, under the pen name Carmichael Smith. Leinbarger had a Ph.D. in political science and helped develop psychological warfare techniques for the government's Office of War Information during World War II. After the war, he taught classes in psychological warfare for the CIA. And not long out of print, the book reflected several elements of the genre, such as a
super spy and by the name of Major Michael Dugan and Fear of Nuclear Annihilation. You know, it contains some fantastic elements the novel draws on Leinbarger's experience developing psychological warfare techniques for the U.S. government. But it, as you would expect, focuses on a single individual saving the day, which doesn't accurately describe the agency's worker culture. Excuse me. Another former CIA officer turned novelist was Charles McCary. His long career included a stint in the Army, speechwriter for President Eisenhower, and editor-at-large for National Geographic. Following his departure from the CIA in 1967, McCary focused on writing novels, many of them featuring the exploits of Paul Christopher, who works for an organization called The Outfit, which is in thinly disguised CIA. In the first of seven Christopher novels, the Miernik dossier was published in 1973, later hailed as the finest modern American spy story. He was quite explicit in his books that his books were works of fiction that expressed no specific details about his life in the CIA, but rather the atmosphere of that secret life. He also observed that on a few occasions when he did adapt specific experiences for his novels, people routinely cited these episodes as too outlandish to be believed. And then there was another well-known novelist with a CIA pedigree, conservative political commentator William F. Buckley, worked for the agency for 2 years after graduating from Yale in 1951. Buckley was stationed in Mexico City where he befriended future Watergate defendant Dean Howard Hunt. In 1976, Buckley published Saving the Queen, a novel featuring CIA officer Blackford Oakes, a character with striking similarities to Buckley himself. Wrote the novels in part to counteract what he saw as the immorality of authors Graham Greene and John Le Carré, whose world-weary protagonists were often mostly indistinguishable from their enemies. Each of Buckley's 11 spy novels are grounded in the real world. Oakes interacts with historical figures such as President Kennedy and Fidel Castro and British double agent Kim Philby. More than many other authors, Buckley was able to marry the reality of intelligence work with the swashbuckling style that became a hallmark of the genre, all the while producing novels that achieved a substantial critical acclaim. In fact, his second Oakes novel, Stained Glass, won the National Book Award in 1980. Well, the best-known American spy novelist is Tom Clancy. His Jack Ryan novels have sold millions of copies and been adapted into several movies and TV programs. In fact, we started the Jack Ryan series last night on streaming TV, and it's excellent. Unlike the other authors I've mentioned up to this point, Clancy had no intelligence experience. He was an insurance agent when his first novel, The Hunt for Red October, was published in 1984. And went on to become a bestseller, and that launched him into the top tier of American novelists. In 1990, The Hunt for Red October was adapted into a film, followed by several other Clancy novels, such as Patriot Games in 92 and Clear and Present Danger in 94, Some of All Fears in 2002, among others. And each of these novels focuses on the exploits of CIA analyst Jack Ryan, who eventually ascends to the presidency of the United States. Hunt for Red October won praise for its highly accurate technical details, and the Bush administration even considered hiring him for the National Space Council in 1989. However, in correspondence with CIA, which saw a great deal of value in Clancy's positive depiction of the agency and his officers, the author admitted he consciously depicted covert operations inaccurately. In the same category as Clancy's, Robert Ludlum. He wrote 27 novels, three of which featured David Webb, a CIA officer who's been brainwashed into believing he's an American traitor named Jason Bourne and who's tasked with killing the notorious assassin Carlos the Jackal. Ludlum's depiction of the CIA is almost the inverse of Clancy's. where Clancy sees the agency's officers heroically battling the forces of totalitarianism, Ludlum depicts the CIA's ruthless and immoral. The most fantastical element of the plot, David Webb's brainwashing, is based on actual experiments, unsuccessful experience, I might add, that the CIA conducted as part of MKUltra. Ludlum may have also based elements of the Bourne novels on a tragic real-life story of Ansel Bourne, a 19th-century Frenchman who woke one morning to find that in a fugue state, he had been living a completely different life from the one he's remembered. Obviously, there are just a few of the many novelists writing spy fiction, a genre that emerged and grew at nearly the same time as the CIA. Many of the best-known fictional American spies, such as Paul Christopher and Blackford Oakes, were created by men with first-hand knowledge of the intelligence world, while others, like Jack Ryan's creator Tom Clancy, relied on assistance from agency insiders. These novelists often mixed real-life elements in their fictional worlds, depicting the CIA with varying degrees of accuracy and sometimes in ways the agents would prefer were reality. Ironically, in some instances, the general public doubted the authenticity of plot elements the authors drew from actual CIA operations and experience, proving once again that there's truth is quite often stranger than fiction. You know, there's no doubt that there's a lot of stuff that has gone on, that operations that are taking place that are just too wild for folks to believe they actually happened. Some of the things I got involved in, looking back, I don't believe they happened. But at the same time, you have to keep in mind that when push comes to shove, you react as you have to react in order to save your own rear, so to speak. Now, part and parcel with talking about intelligence operation and spies, there have long been legends of what are referred to as invisible masters. And they're said to be a council of 33 who actually directs what the various countries do. Now, is that real? Or is that legend? Well, in actuality, there's less proof that it's fiction than there is that it's real. For example, let's go back to Moses and the burning bush for a minute. I talked about this in an earlier show. It could be magic that a bush burned but wasn't consumed. Or it could be what's been referred to in some quarters as God's technology, which for us humans is obviously an alien technology and allows us to do extraordinary things. According to some occult teachings, all souls are born on the divine plane and descend down through the lower planes. However, souls will work their way back to the divine plane. You know, initiates, those who become able to learn some of these so-called higher truths, come to realize that esoteric cosmology, a plane other than the physical plane, is conceived as a subtle state of consciousness which transcends the known physical universe. A world of force is invisible to us and unknown to most people, but visible and well known to the magician and Illuminati like Moses. And Moses was trained in Egyptian secrets. You know, Moses, by all accounts, was aware of different fields of energy present in the so-called etheric body that are in continuous vibration, connecting to energy vortexes called chakras, that are in turn placed in the etheric body
And some of the secret orders, and I discovered to my absolute surprise, a lot of folks I've come to know who've been in government service forever are all members of various secret societies. Now, you've got to ask yourself, is that, it's almost which came first, the chicken or the egg situation. Did they get to the positions they've gotten to in government because they were members of the secret societies? Or did they join the secret societies after they became high up in the hierarchy, so to speak? Now, looking back at Moses for a moment, who is historically a often referred to as an Egyptian Edom. He arrived at Mount Sinai 3 months after leaving Egypt with the Israelites, and the Lord met Moses several times on his favorite mountain surrounded by a dense cloud, warning that nobody could climb up for any reason during the secret meeting. If you look at Exodus chapter 19, verse 12, put limits on the people around the mountain and tell them, be careful that y'all don't approach the mountain or touch the foot of it. Whoever touches the nose of the mountain is going to be put to death. Now, this suggests that there was some kind of interdimensional doorway created for Moses on this mountain, where an alien angelic entity appeared to him early in the Serbal cave and was handling the whole affair on behalf of God. It was creating a sort of transcendental operative base for him. Subsequently, many luminescent clouds covered the top of the mountain as other alien entities were possibly arriving on top of Mount Sinai to meet up with Moses. Most extraterrestrial beings visiting our planet are actually extra-dimensional in nature, but limited to travel within and across specific dimensional portals like Mount Sinai. Moses entered the clouds and disappeared for several days or weeks. Well, you know he had to eat. You know, the human body has certain needs, but he went up the mountain carrying nothing. And this disappearing into nothingness, so to speak, for days or weeks is just like some alleged alien abductions. Here in an extra-dimensional reality, the space-time continuum is certainly different than ours. During that time frame, Moses was taught many things and given various orders to build different objects. This was typically the Egyptian priestly tradition to which Moses belonged. Remember, he was the adopted son of Pharaoh. He was an Egyptian priest himself. The alien forces leading Moses seemed to have instructed him on the construction of objects much more powerful than ones used by the Egyptian enemy. In this context, Moses received from the Lord and his angels the design for a weird ark-shaped instrument, later called the Ark of the Covenant, also referred to as the Ark of Elohim, the gold-covered wooden chest with a lid, described in the book of Exodus as containing the two stone tablets of the Ten Commandments. According to some researchers, this device is supposed to be a communications device, or, in the alternative, a very powerful weapon. And for others, a device that allowed travel between dimensions or alternate universes or planes of existence. It was called the Ark of the Covenant because it represented the covenant between God and the Jewish people. And it's said to be comprised of pure gold, a noble metal considered of great importance by some alien species like the Anunnaki, and suggested by Zechariah Sitchin that the Anunnaki were brethren of the Elohim. You know, in the Bible, like in Exodus book, chapter 25, the Ark is described in great detail. According to a member of the highly influential Boutros Ghali family, gold and diamonds are the only minerals used for the construction of spaceships for these alien species. They're the same ones revered and worshipped by the Illuminati. So the mysterious Ark of the Covenant could be many things, but it definitely is an alien artifact of some kind. You know, when you delve deeply into and this is where the secret world of spies kind of overlaps with the world of the invisible master, so to speak. At a certain level, you wind up in contact with folks that you would never in any other circumstances want to have anything to do with. And quite often you learn things that can shake how you view the world. Now, there's been a number of other items referred to as God's technology. The a number of Freemasons that I know describe the Ark as a sort of electric battery in use in ancient Egypt. The hypothesis is supported by the studies of some fringe archaeologists on the bas reliefs found in Hathor Temple. Mainstream Egyptologists take the view it's a typical set of symbolic images from the Egyptian mythology. But after the... And that's referring to the bas-reliefs found in the Hathor Temple. There you find what's now known as the Dendera light, a supposed ancient Egyptian electrical lighting technology depicted on three stone reliefs. I've seen it. It's mind-blowing when you consider the possibilities. Now, after the discovery of the Temple of Dendera in 1857, English scientist Sir William Crookes built what's known as the Crookes tube or the Crookes Hittorf tub. It's an early experimental electrical discharge tube with a partial vacuum used in 1895 by Wilhelm Röntgen. It was used to discover X-rays, of all things. He stumbled on X-rays while experimenting with Leonard and Crookes' tubes and began studying them. So the basis of the X-ray that we use today came out of the walls of an Egyptian temple. Object has so many visible similarities to the battery that appears in the bas-relief found in the temple of Hathor or at Dendera that you wonder why they're still covering up this important discovery. There's a real antique artifact known as the Baghdad Battery with the features of a modern battery that would confirm the interpretation of the bas-relief of Dendera. But as the name suggests, it was found in Persia, not in Egypt. And we're also reminded the Ark was considered a lethal weapon and Israelites treated as one. They kept it wrapped in cloth and leather and men carrying it had to wear special clothes and special shoes. In addition to the Ark of the Covenant, Moses had to build the Tent of Meeting, which is described in Exodus chapter 33. So there's a whole lot more going on than really meets the eye. And on that note, we come to the end of today's show next week. And this is a Friday, so this is the last show of the week. Next week, we'll be talking more about such exciting things as the Baghdad Battery and the... Until then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.